For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. For new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zengate. And this morning, Kazan Titus O'Brien, who is the Shuso or head monk for the spring practice period commitment we're in the middle of, will be giving the talk. So I'm happy to have Kazan giving the talk this morning. Thank you, Kazan.
Thanks, Taigen.
Good morning, everybody. Friendly bodhisattvas. So we've been studying practice instructions, or practicing with practice instructions, from cultivating the empty field, the silent illumination of Zen Master Hongzhi. Our little satellite sangha in Albuquerque. We've been studying this book for the last 6 months or so, since Taigen came in October and did a seminar, sort of an all-day workshop with this text. And since then, we've been slowly just taking a case each week and studying them. And we're continuing in this practice period to work in particular with six different cases that Taigen selected. But I found my attention wandering to his religious verses, which begin on page 57 in the text. And one in particular sort of captured my attention and my imagination, his poem to Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. But before I talked about the poem, which is quite short, packed, I thought we might could use a little bit of background about Samantabhadra and about bodhisattvas in general. So I'm going to just do, I'm attempting to do a very quick overview here. And to do that, I'm relying on another of Taigen's books and highly recommend it to all of you, called Faces of Compassion. I'm sure many of you have read it already. Classic Bodhisattva Archetypes in Their Modern Expression, An Introduction to Mahayana Buddhism. So Zen has its roots and its foundation in Mahayana Buddhism. So just kind of an introduction, there's sort of early Buddhism. And then after a few hundred years, there was kind of what we might call a reform movement. We could call it an evolution, an augmentation, but a different flowering occurred. Sometimes it's referred to as the second turning of the wheel. The distinguishing feature of the Mahayana movement could be described as the emphasis on this bodhisattva archetype. So traditionally this is understood as Buddhas sort of attain awakening and then they are free from the cyclic wheel of rebirth and they no longer reincarnate and they share this wisdom while they're here with us. They set an example and then they leave. The bodhisattva archetype, on the other hand, is traditionally understood that these are beings who have the capacity and see the potential of full enlightenment and leaving, you know, this cyclic plane of existence and samsara, but they choose to stick around and help indefinitely until all other beings attain the same realization or capacity. That's the sort of traditional understanding. As this book describes, there are different archetypes. There are different archetypal bodhisattvas. And we might be more familiar with a couple of them. the two most well-known, the most well-known is Avalokiteshvara, or Kanzeon in Japanese, Kwannon in Korean, and often depicted as a female deity. We commonly seen in Chinese restaurants or Chinese art collections. You'll see many, many hundreds, even thousands of different incarnations of Kuan Yin, this bodhisattva of compassion. So she's the bodhisattva of compassion, of open listening, of tenderheartedness. Traditionally in a Zen monastery, in the Zendo, which is sort of the heart of a monastery, the deity bodhisattva archetype that's depicted in the Zendo is Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, often depicted riding a lion with a double-edged sword that both takes life and gives life. Very resonant archetype. So that's usually the deity that would be depicted in a larger, more complex temple. And we see Manjushri in the front of the Shakyamuni altar there. So another wonderful archetype that is relatively well known. The third most prominent archetype, I would say, among the bodhisattvas is Samantabhadra. But Samantabhadra is much less often depicted, much more rare. Often seen along with Manjushri as attendants to the Buddha, maybe on either side of an altar figure. And Samantabhadra is the name is often translated as bright virtue, great capacity, great worthiness. And this is the bodhisattva of great activity, compassionate, skillful activity in the world. But as Taigen sort of unpacks in faces of compassion, it's an elusive kind of archetype, or a very broad-reaching sort of archetype that includes, well, as many activities as as we, all of us here, engage in individually and collectively as a group. We have many hands and many skills and many capacities. Some of the themes that Taigen outlines here would be, he uses examples, historical examples and literary examples that we might be familiar with. So for Samantabhadra, he points out Gandhi, Martin Luther King, among sort of political and social activists. He also points to Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring. So he's sort of pointing to Samantabhadra as something like, there's a correspondence with sort of a patron saint idea from a different tradition. It's different, but that's one kind of correspondence that we could think of. So Rachel Carson, with Samantabhadra being sort of associated with environmentalism, environmental activism, this expansive idea of identifying with and protecting this entire world, making it a safe place for bodhisattvas to emerge and engage in enlightening activity. As an artist myself, and by calling, I was most intrigued with Taigen extending this archetype to include William Blake, one of my favorite artists and poets, the 18th century a British visionary prophetic figure. And making that association sort of points us towards the central text of Samantabhadra, Bodhisattva, which is the Avatamsaka Sutra. So there are a number of these great Mahayana sutra texts that, again, distinguishing them from maybe earlier Buddhist texts, they're very cosmic. We might even could say psychedelic. So often they involve a relatively conventional, say, prosaic encounter of the Buddha beginning to give a speech, much like the earlier sutras would, in which he would expound some very clear and lucid teachings about meditation practice and practice in the world. But then they quickly expand, and suddenly you're envisioning, they're being envisioned millions of world systems with millions of Buddhas simultaneously expounding these teachings. And each of these Buddhas are attended by tens of thousands of bodhisattvas who all have these retinue, who have jeweled canopies and, you know, there are jeweled trees and the whole planets are jeweled. And it's you know, it's really, they're very wonderful to read. It takes a kind of shift in awareness, a visionary shift. And maybe we can appeal to this Samantabhadra archetype to help facilitate this sort of shift in awareness as we encounter these texts. But in the Avatamsaka in particular, the entire thing, it's over 2,000 pages, I think, in translation, but it's tiny type, very thick, very mind-blowing, but also very practical in a lot of ways, like Samantabhadra. So it's these two sides of sort of, and this is a very interesting leap. And as we get to Hongzhe's poem, I think he'll sort of indicate ways in which this this makes the Zen leap into kind of a unified expression between this practicality and this visionary capacity. So the Avatamsaka Sutra does the same thing. It's not pithy, it's not terse, it's not a little soundbite that you can walk away with. It's actually a practice text. And if and when you're ever tempted or inspired to engage the Avatamsaka, I personally find it very helpful to recite out loud. This is a storied, millennia-long practice. We can recite the text out loud. And I personally just like to read it and then not do a lot of analysis or even figure out how am I going to incorporate this. It's a different kind of mindset. And it culminates with a vision of Samantabhadra. So this entire book goes on and on and on and on and on, and it can take years to read. And then it finally culminates in this vision of Samantabhadra. So this is all good to know as we enter into this poem, because we have to understand that Hongzhe's teaching, like all of these other great Zen ancestors that we read, foremost among them Dogen, of course, these people were very conversant with, they're emerging out of this ground of Mahayana Buddhist understanding and cosmology, if you will. One thing I wanted to, just one specific line from well, I guess there's two things I wanted to point out about Samantabhadra from Faces of Compassion. Samantabhadra is particularly known for his set of 10 vows. Even the pronoun his here is kind of interesting. It's another interesting point about Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra is, if Kuan Yin is usually depicted as female, Manjushri is usually depicted as male, more quintessentially female and male. Samantabhadra is often depicted as the most, I would say of this three, and Taigen could correct me if I'm wrong here, but Samantabhadra is usually more gender neutral. The David Bowie, the Ziggy Stardust of the Mahayana universe, maybe, gender bending a little bit. Interestingly, the color of Samantabhadra is violet, specifically because it's the that's the mixture of red and blue, fire, water, male, female, yin, yang. So when those things are merged, you get violet. So that's I find that a really interesting aspect, like, you know, concretization or manifestation in form of what, in symbolic form of what Samantabhadra represents. Again, it's these meetings of the very large and the very small, the very internal and the very external, the visionary and the concrete. This is very, very interesting. Samantabhadra is particularly known for his set of 10 vows, which have significant implications for his archetypal character. The 10 are venerating Buddhas, praising Buddhas, making offerings to Buddhas, confessing one's own past misdeeds, rejoicing in the happiness of others, requesting Buddhas to teach, requesting Buddhas not to enter nirvana, studying the Dharma in order to teach it, benefiting all beings, and transferring one's merit to others. So again, these are, we're not going to go very far down that road, that's another Dharma talk, but how these can potentially be practices. I was very struck reading them this time at an interesting correspondence with 12-step programs. In particular, how the fourth of these 10 practices is confessing one's own past misdeeds, and the fourth step in the 12-step programs is doing the same. It's sort of owning and confessing one's problematic misdeeds and kind of tendencies, and owning those, atoning with those. I just think it's really interesting. It's something that just struck me, and I'm going to sort of maybe investigate a little bit more for myself. But there are interesting correspondences there. But there's a really beautiful quote. Let's see. There's my marker. The aesthetic wondrous quality of his vision illustrates that Samantabhadra performs bodhisattva activity because it is beautiful. To be in accord with enlightened truth, aligned with all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, is simply the most pleasing and joyful of lifestyles for Samantabhadra. So, kind of in keeping with Hongzhe, who really indicates this way that our practice should sort of be suffused with a sense of joy and pleasure even. So I like that we can, that Samantabhadra points to us how we can acknowledge and underscore how when we enter the Zendo, it's a very pleasing place to be. It's very carefully appointed. It's quiet and it's still, but it's aesthetically beautiful. It's simple, but there are all these aesthetic archetypal indications. It's an environment that we just experience, too. We don't have to know what all the symbols mean. We can just experience the beauty of it and participate in that. We had a discussion last week, and a number of people, I've heard a number of people just in the last couple weeks since we've been practicing, indicate something like this, which is that we have trouble allowing ourselves to just experience pleasure. Like some people are adjusting their bodies and things so that we're taking care of ourselves. There can be this ascetic component, and we do have to exert some discipline. It's not the easiest practice in the world. It's not the easiest thing to do, to come here and sit facing the wall and facing ourselves. But as Taigen always says, we're here to enjoy our breathing. We're here to enjoy our inhale and our exhale. We're here to enjoy each other and company and society and how we function coming into the temple and leaving the temple. These are all Samantabhadra practices, bodhisattva practices. And beauty is included in that. Beauty and ease and joy. Samantabhadra is often seen riding an elephant. If Manjushri rides the lion with the sword, Samantabhadra rides a giant white elephant with an umbrella. Just even that image kind of gives us an indication of these different archetypes. And I did one last thing before I get to the Hangzhi. An interesting, I looked up archetype, sort of the Jungian definition of archetype on Wikipedia, and this is what it had to say. Archetypes are inherited potentials which are actualized when they enter consciousness as images or manifest in behavior or interaction with the outside world. They are autonomous and hidden forms which are transformed once they enter consciousness and are given particular expression by individuals and their cultures. So this, as often seems to happen, one of Tigan's favorite images that he often speaks of, I'm sure many of you have heard him speak of the image from the Lotus Sutra. Chapter 15 is the Bodhisattvas emerging from the earth. So the Bodhisattvas emerge from the earth to respond and support living beings. There's an idea here about these archetypes. They lay latent or unconscious. This is the Jungian idea. Until they are activated, until they're called upon. And then we have the responsibility. They don't just... This is how, you know, it's not like a supernatural other force that we appeal to, like a patron saint or something, that then responds. Although maybe there's an element of that. It's so mysterious. It's such a mysterious thing. But another way to understand it is it's a potentiality within our own psyche that stays latent until we call on it, we recognize it, we actualize it in the world. Until that process occurs, then it remains latent. This is a beautiful understanding, way to understand our Zen practice. You know, this is Dogen, that these capacities are latent until we have an opportunity to engage them, recognize them, and support them. So that's a way to think about these Bodhisattva archetypes. History, culture, and personal context shape these manifestations, thereby giving them their specific content. They only acquire solidity, influence, and eventual consciousness in the encounter with empirical facts, or we could just say the world. They cannot be proved so long as they do not manifest themselves concretely. So these things are just purely theoretical until they're engaged and manifested. This is true, I know as an artist, you can have a million ideas, right? Maybe some of you are writers or even scientists or lawyers or whatever. You can have any idea in your head. We're all geniuses in our heads, right? I think that's a saying. But until you actually engage that thing, you don't know what's going to happen. I've often had great ideas for work, and then I do it, and it's terrible. So that shoots down that whole train that I maybe envisioned. So let's get to Hangzhi's poem, because he plays with this in a very instructive way. So let's take a look. How are we doing for time, Tigan? So here's the poem. Poem to Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. I think of it as a song, too. The livelihood of my house is nature's source. In all lands, countless as dusts, Samantabhadra is seen. A rhinoceros horn has a single point. A toad's shadow is transparent. The spirit jewel has nine facets. A line of ants is penetrating. Awakening has no gradual stages and erases embroidered edges. Illusions naturally melt away and blend into the circle. The wondrous response pervades the body without front or back. The ancient flower mirror is not stained by dazzling beauty. So you notice that he doesn't describe Samantabhadra. He doesn't talk in any kind of explicative way, the way I've just done about what this is. It's sort of taken for granted that there's that understanding, possibly. But I think we don't even need to necessarily have that understanding to enter into this poem, but it does add some nuance and flavor. So the livelihood of my house is nature's source. So this is an interesting line to investigate in itself. The livelihood of my house. So I think of this, often the house is the body. You know, we can just think of it as the body. It's also the style of practice. So we practice in the Soto style. So that's a house. It's often described as there's a wind or a flavor of the house, a quality, a style. So it could be referring to that. The livelihood of our house is nature's source. That can be understood in a couple ways as well. What we're investigating is nature's source, you know, where we all join. Where is this all emerging, this activity emerging, and that we all share? And the I Ching talks about the source that we go to for nourishment for ourselves and for the village. You know, what's the original source? So that's one way to understand it. In all lands, countless as dust, Samantabhadra is seen. So this is very interesting because, as I was just talking about the Avatamsaka, Samantabhadra is very difficult to see, in a way. It takes these journeys and pilgrimages and visitations and study and practice. And maybe at the end of that, maybe, you know, Samantabhadra might be seen. But at the same time, Samantabhadra is available and seen everywhere all the time. It's that capacity, that archetypal capacity, is ever present. So he's playing with that, you know, a little bit. A rhinoceros. These next couple lines are great because this is what Hongzhi does, and other teachers in our tradition do as well. The abstract gets really concrete with these poetic images. So a rhinoceros horn has a single point. So just imagine, you know, as that image is conjured, we see this rhinoceros, this sort of ancient unicorn figure, right? And has this massive horn. For me, and this is not doctrinal interpretation, this is just my impression, but it's this giant, massive, powerful, ancient creature that all of that power is kind of focused into this fine point at the front of its body. So that's an image. The next image is, a toad's shadow is transparent. A little more esoteric, maybe. Toads, both in the East and in the West, they have a similar kind of connotation. People are turned into toads in Eastern stories and Western stories. They're warts and all. You know, we're sort of reduced to our shadowy aspects. And yet there's luck, too. You know, you kiss the toad and you get the prince or princess. Something happens in that transformation of the creature. In the East, toads are seen as very lucky. There's this kind of mythical stories, but these lowly creatures are often associated with financial luck, right? So the toad's shadow is transparent. I think pointing to the toad and its shadow, again, it sort of underscores this shadowy nether world aspect. And yet, that shadow is transparent. So for me, this evoked something sort of like our shadow is penetrable. You know, it's we can see through it. We have the capacity to see through our toady shadow, right? Maybe another image of the toad would be like Smeagol from The Lord of the Rings, you know. Even Smeagol's, you know, even his situation's transparent, and that even his bodhisattva capacity occasionally emerges through the slime and the muck. The spirit jewel has nine facets, a line of ants is penetrating. I had a couple insights of talking about this with the Hyde Park group, both before and after. The spirit jewel has nine facets. So this struck me as, you know, our spirit jewel has many facets. We're many faceted creatures. Just like Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra's activity has many facets. It's not just single faceted. Maybe we reduce ourselves to that and we think we should have maybe just a single capacity, or we need to focus on things singly. But I think understanding ourselves as many faceted creatures can maybe be helpful. A line of ants is penetrating. I thought that was an interesting little Salvador Dali kind of imposition into this thing. And, you know, we're jumping from a rhinoceros to a toad, a jewel to ants. This in itself, just doing this to the imagination is, I think, poetically, aesthetically, psychologically, useful, healing. So a spirit jewel has nine facets, a line of ants is penetrating. Nyozan was telling me when he was in the Amazon not so long ago that the camp was penetrated by a line of ants, a massive line of ants, like 3 feet wide and a mile long, and it just marched right through the middle of camp. Started to go into one of the raised huts, so they had to like redirect them, get them going. And so that really brought that image home for me. But yeah, how, you know, marshaling all these individual forces, which alone are not so powerful, but then you put them all together and they can penetrate. Again, I'll just leave the line at that. We have to get through the whole thing. I'll just leave you with that line. What does it mean? Well, I'll leave it with you. Awakening has no gradual stages and erases embroidered edges. So again, Samantabhadra is about all these practices. There are many lists of practices in the Avatamsaka Sutra. His list of vows is quite long. There's often these lists, incredible lists of all the practices that these bodhisattvas have accomplished. And yet awakening has no gradual stages. When we enter into that sort of awakening awareness, we have that sense like, oh, what could be wrong? It's here. It's taking care of itself. It's taking care of me. I'm taking care of it. We don't need embroidered edges. Those kind of fade away. The extra flowery bits that maybe we're adding to the edges of our lives or our activity, those start to blend. Illusions naturally melt away, is the next line, and blend into the circle. Right? It's a nice image. The wondrous response pervades the body without front or back. So again, Hangzhe encouraging us with an awareness to recognize wonder and joy and ease emerging from within our practice. Maybe if we're bearing down a little too hard or something, we can allow this wondrous response to simply pervade the body without front or back. We're not delimiting it to just our Zen time. When we come here, we experience wondrous activity, then we go home and it's miserable. So we just start to see this wondrous response. Or maybe we're really happy at home with our Netflix and our snacks, and then we come here and we're miserable. Maybe these things, those worlds start to, the division starts to blend a little bit. And the last line is, the ancient flower mirror is not stained by dazzling beauty. The ancient flower mirror here is a very evocative image, potentially, of mind. So often This image of the mirror is evoked in many different contexts in the Buddhist and Zen traditions. But this idea of our mind being a mirror that we polish, right, so that it's undefiled or unstained. I love this idea of our mind being an ancient flower mirror. You know, I sort of imagine a brass mirror with an ornate, flowery sort of rim. So this ancient flower mirror is not stained by dazzling beauty. So even though we're maybe dazzled sometimes by the wonder and beauty of existence, still we're just chopping wood. We're still just carrying water. The beauty that Samantabhadra indicates, well, if we get stuck on that, if we get hung up on that, maybe we become aesthetes, you know, and that's kind of a trap too. So we don't get hung up in the aesthetic joy or pleasure. We're liberated even from beauty, which is nice. So that's kind of a few comments about this poem. And I hope that in explicating it like this, that I know a lot of people express befuddlement at these teachings. Like, I don't know what to do with this. This is impenetrable seeming stuff. And all of my interpretations might be completely wrong. However, in familiarizing myself with these teachings over some time, I do feel like I can engage them just with my own mind as it is and my own feelings, and I can make my own associations. I don't need to be a scholar. I don't need to have a Buddhist glossary or thesaurus next to me all the time to try and figure this stuff out. We can just take it on its own terms. I think Hongzhe is pretty accessible that way. So I encourage us all to just encounter these images, be inspired by them, internalize them, see how it might potentially manifest in our lives, just like Samantabhadra activity. So I'll leave it at that, and maybe we can have some questions and answers, comments, observations, responses.
Anyone, please do.
So much info. I hope I didn't overwhelm folks. But would anybody like for me to read the poem one more time? Would that be helpful? Okay. The livelihood of my house is nature's source. In all lands countless as dusts, Samantabhadra is seen. A rhinoceros horn has a single point. A toad's shadow is transparent. The spirit jewel has nine facets. A line of ants is penetrating. Awakening has no gradual stages and erases embroidered edges. Illusions naturally melt away and blend into the circle. The wondrous response pervades the body without front or back. The ancient flower mirror is not stained by dazzling beauty.
I'll just note that I appreciated the interpretations you gave to all those images. I have very different interpretations to each of them, but it's not that there are, you know, are right or wrong interpretations. These are poetic images that can evoke various. So, if anyone has any.
Because I don't know, when I was a kid, you know, I'm a farm, so occasionally I'm going to mess with the monuments, and
Yeah, that's such a wonderful image. I suddenly was struck by how it's the bookmark there, is the poem. You know, ants getting into the kitchen must have been as obviously as big or bigger problem in, you know, medieval China when he was writing this as it is for us today. And that idea of the tenaciousness, their capacity to find these sources of food, and they're sort of relentless. They can be quite difficult to dissuade from going the direction they want to. And yeah, you brush them away, and they keep coming back. That's certainly an interesting way to think about how we approach our practice too. There's a sort of tenacity. That's just persistent. It's not, you know, they're not storming the castle. They're just persistently seeking nourishment and support for their communities. That's a really, you know, thanks for bringing that up. It just, again, starts to open up that archetype, that image in new ways, interesting ways. Yeah. Yeah.
I've always really enjoyed the archetype of the snow cloud, and I'm really glad we're talking about them today. One thing that stood out to me in your talk was playing with how, you know, that sutra that's associated with the snow cloud, or I forget the name of it.
Avatamsaka?
Avatamsaka.
Sutra.
Ornamental Sutra is 2,000 pages, and Hanuman's poem to them is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great, you know, but it showed the, you know, the maybe in that relief, the full capacity of Samas Bhadra is there, you know, of the having the context of, you know, a seemingly shorter ode. And the flower and the sutra, they're both expressions or manifestations or evocations.
Well, that's kind of another twist, too, on Tigan's translating the title Avatamsaka into flower ornament or flower garland sutra. The ancient. Yeah.
It's flower ornament sutra.
Right. So the flower, ancient flower mirror, that's another kind of echo. This sense of these sort of flower garlands. Flowers are such a powerful image in these Mahayana sutras. There's often raining flowers, jeweled flowers, flower fields, flowering trees, flowers. Not being, you know, this original flower mirror not being stained by all this dazzling beauty. Leaving no trace. We've been talking about that. That's come up recently. Yeah. Traceless activity. Other comments? Questions? Impressions? Yeah, Howard.
I'm always curious about the ways in which figures, writers in Buddhist tradition use text as a skillful means in very different ways. Dave just mentioned, there's how many lines of the Avatamsaka Sutra?
Let's say 10. Dave said 10. Right.
He said 10. Well, 10 lines in the Hanja, but
yeah.
The flower ornaments so much longer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find it really interesting because, you know, as Samatha Bhadra, as the Bodhisattva of great activity and skillful means, that Hongja evokes Samantabhadra and basically takes a lot of classic images from the Buddhist tradition and slams them all together to make something really incredibly evocative, not just in a, it could be in a generally poetic kind of way, but like there's the evocation of Samantabhadra, there's the rhinoceros, and I think about the rhinoceros fan koan. I think about like the last image of the not stained by dazzling beauty in the mirror. I think of Huineng and the sort of conversation that happens, exchange that happens between various different figures in the tradition. And it's just nice seeing all these images and all these different ways of teaching come together into this poem, which in itself is another way of, does this work for you? Does this speak to you? In what way does it speak to you? How does this affect your practice? What can you bring to it in your practice? I just am fascinated all the time by the way the Buddhist tradition teaches you in different ways.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this is so true to Zen texts. Now, it can start, again, we can get kind of hobbled or stumble by how many references. Some translators, like Cleary in particular, I'm thinking of when he translates Dogen. Dogen makes so many allusions to other texts and other writings and other stories that Cleary will often put those in these quotation marks, or not in quotation marks, but in italics, so that a paragraph of Dogen will be full of all these italic phrases, and those indicate to you in a way that's not really in the original text, but are very helpful for us encountering these texts, that it's these allusions, these references to these other stories. So we could kind of use air quotes, you know, the rhinoceros horn, the flower mirror, you know, we could sort of do that, although it can feel a little disingenuous, you know, a little Seinfeld-y or something. It's not quite like that, but and it's just such an evocative, powerful idea, even just about language and about creativity, that, you know, all art is in conversation with other art. It's standing on the shoulders of those giants. It's, you know, making all these references all the time. We could call it appropriation too, you know. There's a kind of a postmodern, a hip-hop kind of quality to Dogen and to Hongzhe, you know, to any of these Zen teachers. They're constantly referencing other people, not to embroider the edges, although some of them I'm sure did that too. It's not to embroider the edges to make it, to puff it up, but rather to just show how we're in these very long-term human conversations that extend before us. And in making these references, we're invoking our ancestors, we're paying homage to them. It's also extending forward in time and leaving the possibility for those who come after, they can play with these texts too. They can play with these ideas, express them in different ways, understand them in different ways.
Thank you for that, Pedro.
Yeah.
I'll just add one more comment on an image. Toad shadow is transparent. Mm. Forget what you said about that. You had some interesting reference to that. But I reminded us of Hiroshi, whose favorite animal was toad or a frog, just sitting there waiting for sitting quietly, still, like in Zazen, waiting for quiet. So, we'll close on that note. And,